a single tooth remaining.
"Give me wine, or I will go. My bones are old, my joints ache when the winds do blow, and up here the winds are always blowing."
"A silver stag for your dreams, my lady," Lord Berwick said, with solemn courtesy. "Another, if you have news for us."
"I cannot take a silver stag, nor ride one. A skin of wine for my dreams, and for my news, a kiss from the great oaf in the yellow cloak."
The little woman cackled.
"Aye, a sloppy kiss. A bit of tongue. It has been too long, oh, too long. His mouth will taste of lemons and mine of bones. I am too old."
"Aye," Lem complained. "Too old for wine and kisses. All you get from me is the flat of my sword, crone."
"My hair comes out in handfuls, and no one has kissed me for 1,000 years. It's hard to be so old. Well, I will have a song then, a song from Thomas Evans for my news."
"You will have your song from Tom," Lord Berwick promised. He gave her the wineskin himself. The dwarf woman drank deep, the wine running down her chin. When she lowered the skin, she wiped her mouth with the back of a wrinkled hand and said,
"Sour wine for sour tidings. What could be more fitting? The king is dead. Is that sour enough for you?"
Arya's heart caught in her throat. "Which bloody king is dead, crone?" Lem demanded.
"The wet one. The Kraken King, my lords. I dreamt him dead, and he died. And the iron squids now turn on one another. Oh, and Lord Hoster Tully has died, too. But you know that, don't you? In the Hall of Kings, the goat sits alone and fevered as the great dog descends on him."
The old woman took another long gulp of wine, squeezing the skin as she raised it to her lips. The great dog? Did she mean the hound? Or maybe his brother, the mountain that rides? Arya was not certain. They bore the same arms, 3 black dogs on a yellow field. Half the men whose deaths she prayed for belonged to Sir Gregor Clegane, Polliver, Dunson, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler, and Sir Gregor himself. Maybe Lord Berwick will hang them all.
"I dreamt a wolf howling in the rain, but no one heard his grief,"
the dwarf woman was saying.
"I dreamt such a clangor, I thought my head might burst, drums and horns and pipes and screams. But the sad sound was the little bells. I dreamt of a maid at a feast with purple serpents in her hair, venom dripping from their fangs. And later I dreamt that maid again, slaying a savage giant in a castle built of snow."
She turned her head sharply and smiled through the gloom right at Arya.
"You cannot hide from me, child. Come closer now."
Cold fingers walked down Arya's neck. Fear cuts deeper than swords, she reminded herself. She stood and approached the fire warily, light on the balls of her feet, poised to flee. The dwarf woman studied her with dim red eyes.
"I see you," she whispered. "I see you, wolf child, blood child. I thought it was the Lord who smelled of death."
She began to sob, her little body shaking.
"You're cruel to come to my hill. Cruel, I gauged on grief at summer hall. I need none of yours. Begone from here, dark heart, begone."
There was such fear in her voice that Arya took a step backward, wondering if the woman was mad.
"Don't frighten the child," Thoris protested. "There's no harm in her."
Lem Lemoncloak's finger went to his broken nose. "Don't be so bloody sure of that." "She will leave on the morrow with us," Lord Beric assured the little woman. "We're taking her to River Run, to her mother."
"Nay,"
said the dwarf.
"You're not. The black fish holds the rivers now. If it's the mother you want, seek her at the twins, for there is to be a wedding."
She cackled again.
"Look in your fires, Pink Priest, and you will see. Not now, though. Not here. You see nothing here. This place belongs to the old gods still. They linger here, as I do, shrunken and feeble, but not yet dead. Nor do they love the flames, for the oak recalls the acorn. The acorn dreams the oak. The stump lives in them both. And they remember when the first men came with fire in their fists."
She drank the last of the wine in four long swallows, flung the skin aside, and pointed her stick at Lord Beric.
"I'll have my payment now. I'll have the song you promised me."
And so Lem woke Tom Sevenstrings beneath his furs and brought him, yawning, to the fireside with his woodharp in hand.
"The same song as before?" he asked. "Why, my Jenny's song. Is there another?"
And so he sang. And the dwarf woman closed her eyes and rocked slowly back and forth, murmuring the words and crying. Thoris took Arya firmly by the hand and drew her aside.
"Let her savour her song in peace," he said. "That is all she has left."
I wasn't going to hurt her, Arya thought.
What did she mean about the twins? My mother's at River Run, isn't she?
She was, the Red Priest rubbed beneath his chin.
"A wedding," she said. "We shall see. Whenever she is, Lord Beric will find her, though."
Not long after, the sky opened, lightning cracked, and thunder rolled across the hills, and the rain fell in blinding sheets. The dwarf woman vanished, as suddenly as she had appeared, while the outlaws gathered branches and threw up crude shelters. It rained all through that night, and come morning, Ned, Lem, and Watty the Miller awoke with chills. Watty could not keep his breakfast down, and young Ned was feverish and shivering by turns, with skin clammy to the touch. There was an abandoned village half a day's ride to the north, Notch told Lord Beric. They'd find better shelter there, a place to wait out the worst of the rains. So they dragged themselves back into the saddles and urged their horses down the great hill. The rains did not let up. They rode through woods and fields, fording swollen streams where the rushing water came up to the bellies of their horses. Arya pulled up the hood of her cloak and hunched down, sudden and shivering, but determined not to falter. Merritt and Mudge were soon coughing, as bad as Watty, and poor Ned seemed to grow more miserable with every mile.
"When I wear my helm, the rain beats against the steel and gives me headaches," he complained. "And when I take it off, my hair gets soaked and sticks to my face and in my mouth." "You have a knife," Gendry suggested. "If your hair annoys you so much, shave your bloody head."
"He doesn't like Ned." The squire seemed nice enough to Arya. Maybe a little shy, but good-natured. She had always heard that Dornishmen were small and swarthy, with black hair and small black eyes. But Ned had big blue eyes, so dark that they looked almost purple. And his hair was pale blonde, more ash than honey. "How long have you been Lord Beric's squire?" she asked, to take his mind from his misery.
"He took me for his page when he espoused my aunt," he coughed. "I was 7. But when I turned 10, he raised me to squire. I won a prize once, riding at rings."
"I never learned the lance, but I could beat you with a sword," said Arya. "Have you killed anyone?" That seemed to startle him.
"I'm only 12.
"I killed a boy when I was 8. Arya almost said, but she thought she'd better not. "You've been in battles, though."
"Yes."
He did not sound very proud of it.
I was at the Mummer's Ford when Lord Berwick fell into the river. I dragged him up onto the bank so he wouldn't drown and stood over him with my sword. I never had to fight, though. He had a broken lance sticking out of him, so no one bothered us. When we regrouped, Green Gergen helped pull his lordship back onto a horse.
Arya was remembering the stable boy at King's Landing. After him, there'd been that guard whose throat she'd cut at Harrenhal, and Sir Aymer's men at that holdfast by the lake. She didn't know if Wheeze and Chiswick counted, or the ones who died on account of the weasel soup.
All of a sudden, she felt very sad. "My father was called Ned, too," she said. "I know. I saw him at the Hans Tourney. I wanted to go up and speak with him, but I couldn't think what to say."
Ned shivered beneath his cloak, a sudden length of pale purple.
"Were you at the Tourney? I saw your sister there. Sir Loras Tyrell gave her a rose.
She told me.
It all seemed so long ago.
Her friend, Jane Poole, fell in love with your Lord Berwick.
He's promised her my aunt."
Ned looked uncomfortable.
"That was before, though. Before he...
died," she thought, as Ned's voice trailed off into an awkward silence. Their horses' hooves made sucking sounds as they pulled free of the mud.
"My lady,"
Ned said at last,
"you have a base-born brother, John Snow.
He's with the Night's Watch on the wall.
Maybe I should go to the wall instead of River Run. John wouldn't care who I killed or whether I brush my hair.
John looks like me, even though he's bastard-born. He used to muss my hair and call me little sister."
Arya missed John most of all. Just saying his name made her sad.
"How do you know about John?" "He is my milk brother."
"Brother?"
Arya did not understand.
"But you're from Dorne. How could you and John be blood?"
"Milk brothers, not blood. My lady mother had no milk when I was little, so Willa had to nurse me."
Arya was lost.
"Who's Willa?" "John Snow's mother."
"He never told you?"
"She served us for years and years, since before I was born."
"John never knew his mother, not even her name." Arya gave Ned a wary look.
"You know her, truly?"
"Is he making muck of me?"
"If you lie, I'll punch your face." "Willa was my wet nurse," he repeated solemnly. "I swear it on the honour of my house."
"You have a house?"
That was stupid. He was a squire. Of course he had a house.
"Who are you?"
"My lady."
Ned looked embarrassed.
"I'm Edric Dane, the Lord of Starfall."
Behind them, Gendry groaned.
"Lords and ladies,"
he proclaimed in a disgusted tone. Arya plucked a withered crab-apple off a passing branch and whipped it at him, bouncing it off his thick bull head.
"Ow!"
he said.
"That hurt!"
He felt the skin above his eye.
"What kind of lady throws crab-apples at people?"
"The bad kind," said Arya, suddenly contrite. She turned back to Ned. "I'm sorry, I didn't know who you were, my lord."
"The fault is mine, my lady."
He was very polite.
"John has a mother. Willa. Her name is Willa."
She would need to remember so she could tell him the next time she saw him. She wondered if he would still call her little sister.
"I'm not so little any more, and had to call me something else."
Maybe once she got to River Run, she could write John a letter and tell him what Ned Dane had said.
There was an Arthur Dane, she remembered, the one they called the Sword of the Morning. My father was Sir Arthur's elder brother. Lady Ashara was my aunt. I never knew her, though. She threw herself into the sea from atop the pale stone sword before I was born.
Why would she do that?
Said Arya, startled. Ned looked weary. Maybe he was afraid that she was going to throw something at him.
Your lord father never spoke of her,
he said.
The Lady Ashara Dane of Starfall.
No, Did he know her?
Before Robert was king, she met your father and his brothers at Harrenhal during the year of the false spring.
Oh, Arya did not know what else to say.
Why did she jump in the sea, though?
Her heart was broken.
Sansa would have sighed and shed a tear for true love, but Arya just thought it was stupid. She couldn't say that to Ned, though, not about his own aunt.
Did someone break it?
He hesitated.
Perhaps it's not my place. Tell me.
He looked at her uncomfortably.
My aunt Illyria said Lady Ashara and your father fell in love at Harrenhal.
That's not so. He loved my lady mother.
I'm sure he did, my lady, but she was the only one he loved.
He must have found that bastard under a cabbage leaf, then,
Gendry said behind them. Arya wished she had another crab-apple to bounce off his face.
My father had honour, she said angrily, and we weren't talking to you anyway. Why don't you go back to Stony Sept and ring that girl's stupid bells?
Gendry ignored that.
At least your father raised his bastard, not like mine. I don't even know my father's name. Some smelly drunk, I'll wager, like the others my mother dragged home from the alehouse. Whenever she got mad at me, she'd say, "If your father was here, he'd beat you bloody." That's all I know of him.
He spat.
Well, if he was here now, might be I'd beat him bloody. But he's dead, I figure. And your father's dead, too. So, what does it matter who he lay with?
It mattered to Arya, though she could not have said why. Ned was trying to apologize for upsetting her, but she did not want to hear it. She pressed her heels into her horse and left them both. Angai the archer was riding a few yards ahead. When she caught up with him, she said,
Dornishmen lie, don't they?
Oh, they're famous for it,
the bowman grinned.
Of course, they say the same of us marchers. So, there you are. What's the trouble now? Ned's a good lad.
He's just a stupid liar.
Arya left the trail, leapt a rotten log, and splashed across a stream bed, ignoring the shouts of the outlaws behind her. They just want to tell me more lies. She thought about trying to get away from them, but there were too many, and they knew these lands too well. What was the use of running if they caught you? It was Harwin who rode up beside her in the end.
Where do you think you're going, my lady? You shouldn't run off. There are walls in these woods, and worse things.
I'm not afraid, she said. That boy Ned said.
He told me. Lady Ashara Dane. It's an old tale, that one. I heard it once at Winterfell, when I was no older than you are now.
He took hold of her bridle firmly, and turned her horse around.
I doubt there's any truth to it, but if there is, what of it? When Ned met this Dornish lady, his brother Brandon was still alive, and it was him betrothed to Lady Catelyn, so there's no stain on your father's honour. There's naught like a tourney to make the blood run hot. So maybe some words were whispered in a tent of a knight, who can say? Words or kisses, maybe more. But where's the harm in that? Spring had come, or so they thought, and neither of them was pledged.
She killed herself, though, said Arya, uncertainly. Ned said she jumped from a tower into the sea.
So she did, Harwin admitted, as he led her back. But that was for grief, I'll wager. She'd lost a brother, the Sword of the Morning. He shook his head. Let it lie, my lady. They're dead, all of them. Let it lie. And please, when we come to River Run, say naught of this to your mother.
The village was just where Notch had promised it would be. They took shelter in a grey stone stable. Only half a roof remained, but that was half a roof more than any other building in the village.
It's not a village, it's only black stones and old bones.
Did the Lannisters kill the people who lived here?
Arya asked, as she helped Angai dry the horses.
No, he pointed. Look at how thick the moss grows on the stones. No one's moved them for a long time. And there's a tree growing out of the wall there, see?
This place was put to the torch a long time ago.
Who did it, then? Asked Gendry.
Oscar Tully.
Nutch was a stoop, thin, grey-haired man, born in these parts.
This was Lord Goodbrook's village. When River Run declared for Robert, Goodbrook stayed loyal to the king. So Lord Tully came down on him with fire and sword. After the trident, Goodbrook's son made his peace with Robert and Lord Oster, but that didn't help the dead none.
A silence fell. Gendry gave Arya a queer look, then turned away to brush his horse. Outside, the rain came down and down.
I say we need a fire,
Thoros declared.
The night is dark and full of terrors, and wet too, eh? Too very wet.
Jack Belucky hacked some dry wood from a stall, while Notch and Merritt gathered straw for kindling. Thoros himself struck the spark, and Lem fanned the flames with his big yellow cloak until they roared and swirled. Soon it grew almost hot inside the stable. Thoros sat before it, cross-legged, devouring the flames with his eyes, just as he had atop High Hart. Arya watched him closely, and once his lips moved, and she thought she heard him mutter,
"River Run."
Lem paced back and forth, coughing, a long shadow matching him stride for stride, while Thomas Evans pulled off his boots and rubbed his feet.
"I must be mad to be going back to River Run," the singer complained. "The Tullys have never been lucky for old Tom. It was that Lyser sent me up the high road, when the Moon Men took my gold and my horse and all my clothes as well. There's knights in the Vale still telling how I came walking up to the bloody gate with only my harp to keep me modest. They made me sing the Name Day Boy and the King Without Courage before they opened that gate. My only solace was that three of them died laughing. I haven't been back to the Eyrie since, and I won't sing the King Without Courage either, not for all the golden Casterly.
Lannisters, Thoris said, roaring red and gold. He lurched to his feet and went to Lord Beric. Lem and Tom wasted no time joining them. Arya could not make out what they were saying, but the singer kept glancing at her, and one time Lem got so angry he pounded his fist against the wall. That was when Lord Beric gestured for her to come closer. It was the last thing she wanted to do, but Harwin put a hand in the small of her back and pushed her forward. She took two steps and hesitated, full of dread.
"My lord."
She waited to hear what Lord Beric would say.
"Tell her,"
the Lightning Lord commanded Thoros. The Red Priest squatted down beside her.
"My lady," he said, "the Lord granted me a view of River Run, an island in a sea of fire, it seemed. The flames were leaping lions with long crimson claws, and how they roared! A sea of Lannisters, my lady. River Run will soon come under attack."
Arya felt as though he'd punched her in the belly. "No."
"Sweetling," said Thoros, "the flames do not lie. Sometimes I read them wrongly, blind fool that I am, but not this time, I think. The Lannisters will soon have River Run under siege."
"Rob will beat them."
Arya got a stubborn look.
"He'll beat them, like he did before."
"Your brother may be gone," said Thoros. "Your mother as well. I did not see them in the flames. This wedding the old one spoke of, a wedding on the twins, she has her own way of knowing things, that one. The werewoods whisper in her ear when she sleeps. If she says your mother is gone to the twins—"
Arya turned on Tom and Lem.
"If you hadn't caught me, I would have been there. I would have been home."
Lord Beric paid no heed to her outburst.
"My lady," he said, with weary courtesy, "would you know your grandfather's brother by sight? Sir Brynden Tully, called the Blackfish? Would he know you, perchance?"
Arya shook her head miserably. She had heard her mother speak of Sir Brynden Blackfish, but if she had ever met him herself, it had been when she was too little to remember.
"Small chance a blackfish will pay good coin for a girl he doesn't know," said Tom. "Those tollies are a sour, suspicious lot. He's like to think we're selling him false goods."
"We'll convince him," Lem Lemoncloak insisted.
"She will, or Harwin. River Run is closest. I say we take her there, get the gold, and be bloody well done with her."
"And if the lions catch us inside the castle," said Tom, "they'd like nothing better than to hang his lordship in a cage from the top of Castley Rock."
"I do not mean to be taken," said Lord Beric.
A final word hung unspoken in the air. "Alive." They all heard it, even Arya, though it never passed his lips.
"Still, we dare not go blindly here. I want to know where the armies are, the wolves and lions both. Sharma will know something, and Lord Vance's maester will know more. Acorn Hall's not far. Lady Smallwood will shelter us for a time while we send scouts ahead to learn."
His words beat at her ears like the pounding of a drum, and suddenly it was more than Arya could stand. She wanted River Run, not Acorn Hall. She wanted her mother and her brother Rob, not Lady Smallwood or some uncle she never knew. Whirling, she broke for the door, and when Harwin tried to grab her arm, she spun away from him, quick as a snake. Outside the stables, the rain was still falling, and distant lightning flashed in the west. Arya ran as fast as she could. She did not know where she was going, only that she wanted to be alone, away from all the voices, away from their hollow words and broken promises. "All I wanted was to go to River Run." It was her own fault for taking Gendry and Hot Pie with her when she left Harrenhal. She would have been better alone. If she had been alone, the outlaws would never have caught her, and she'd be with Rob and her mother by now. "They were never my pack. If they had been, they wouldn't leave me." She splashed through a puddle of muddy water. Someone was shouting her name. Harwin, probably, or Gendry, but the thunder drowned them out as it rolled across the hills, half a heartbeat behind the lightning. "The Lightning Lord," she thought, angrily. Maybe he couldn't die, but he could lie. Somewhere off to her left, a horse whinnied. Arya couldn't have gone more than 50 yards from the stables, yet already she was soaked to the bone. She ducked around the corner of one of the tumble-down houses, hoping the mossy walls would keep the rain off, and almost bowled right into one of the sentries. A mailed hand closed hard around her arm.
"You're hurting me," she said, twisting in his grasp. "Let go. I was going to go back. I—"
"Back?" Sandor Clegane's laughter was iron scraping over stone. "Bugger that, wolf girl. You're mine."
He needed only one hand to yank her off her feet and drag her kicking toward his waiting horse. The cold rain lashed them both and washed away her shouts, and all that Arya could think of was the question he had asked her. "Do you know what dogs do to wolves?"
Jamie. Though his fever lingered stubbornly, the stump was healing clean, and Kyburn said his arm was no longer in danger. Jamie was anxious to be gone, to put Harrenhal, the Bloody Mummers, and Brienne of Tarth all behind him. A real woman waited for him in the Red Keep.
"I'm sending Kyburn with you to look after you on the way to King's Landing," Roose Bolton said on the morning of their departure. "He has a fond hope that your father will force the Citadel to give him back his chain in gratitude."
"We all have fond hopes. If he grows me back a hand, my father will make him Grand Maester."
Steelshanks Walton commanded Jamie's escort, blunt, brusque, brutal, at heart a simple soldier. Jamie had served with his sword all his life. Men like Walton would kill at their lord's command, rape when their blood was up after battle, and plunder wherever they could. But once the war was done, they would go back to their homes, trade their spears for hoes, wed their neighbours' daughters, and raise a pack of squalling children. Such men obeyed without question, but the deep, malignant cruelty of the brave companions was not a part of their nature. Both parties left Harrenhal the same morning, beneath a cold grey sky that promised rain. Sir Aeneas Frey had marched 3 days before, striking north-east for the King's Road. Bolton meant to follow him. "The Trident is in flood," he told Jamie. "Even at the Ruby Ford, the crossing will be difficult. You will give my warm regards to your father."
"So long as you give mine to Rob Stark."
"That I shall."
Some brave companions had gathered in the yard to watch them leave. Jamie trotted over to where they stood.
"Zolo, how kind of you to see me off. Pig, Timian. Will you miss me? No last jest to share, Shagwell? To lighten my way down the road? And Rorg, did you come to kiss me goodbye?"
"Magalof, Crimpon,"
said Rorg. "If you insist. Rest assured, though, I will be back. A Lannister always pays his debts." Jamie wheeled his horse around and rejoined Steelshanks Walton and his 200. Lord Bolton had accoutred him as a knight, preferring to ignore the missing hand that made such warlike garb a travesty. Jamie rode with sword and dagger on his belt, shield and helm hung from his saddle, chainmail under a dark brown surcoat. He was not such a fool as to show the Lion of Lannister on his arms, though, nor the plain white blazon that was his right as a sworn brother of the King's Guard. He found an old shield in the armoury, battered and splintered, the chip paint still showing most of the great black bat of House Luston upon a field of silver and gold. The Lustons held Harrenhal before the Wents, and had been a powerful family in their day, but they had died out ages ago, so no one was likely to object to him bearing their arms. He would be no one's cousin, no one's enemy, no one's sworn sword. In sum, no one. They left through Harrenhal's smaller eastern gate, and took their leave of Roose Bolton and his host 6 miles farther on, turning south to follow along the lake road for a time. Walton meant to avoid the King's Road as long as he could, preferring the farmers' tracks and game trails near the God's Eye. The King's Road would be faster. Jamie was anxious to return to Cersei as quickly as he could. If they made haste, he might even arrive in time for Joffrey's wedding.
"I want no trouble," said Steelshanks. "Gods know who we'd meet along that King's Road."
"No one you need fear, surely. You have 200 men."
"Aye, but others might have more. My lord said to bring you safe to your lord father, and that's what I mean to do."
"I have come this way before," Jamie reflected, a few miles further on, when they passed a deserted mill beside the lake. Weeds now grew where once the miller's daughter had smiled shyly at him, and the miller himself had shouted out,
"The tourney's back the other way, sir." As if I had not known.
King Aerys made a great show of Jamie's investiture. He said his vows before the king's pavilion, kneeling on the green grass in white armour, while half the realm looked on. When Sir Gerald Hightower raised him up and put the white cloak about his shoulders, a roar went up that Jamie still remembered all these years later. But that very night, Aerys had turned sour, declaring that he had no need of 7 King's Guard here at Harrenhal. Jamie was commanded to return to King's Landing to guard the Queen and little Prince Viserys, who'd remained behind. Even when the White Bull offered to take that duty himself, so Jamie might compete in Lord Wen's tourney, Aerys had refused.
"He'll win no glory here," the King had said. "He's mine now, not Tywin's. He'll serve as I see fit. I am the king. I rule, and he'll obey."
That was the first time that Jamie understood. It was not his skill with sword and lance that had won him his white cloak, nor any feats of valour he'd performed against the Kingswood Brotherhood. Aerys had chosen him to spite his father, to rob Lord Tywin of his heir. Even now, all these years later, the thought was bitter. And that day, as he'd ridden south in his new white cloak to guard an empty castle, it had been almost too much to stomach. He would have ripped the cloak off then and there, if he could have, but it was too late. He had said the words whilst half the realm looked on, and a king's guard served for life. Qyburn fell in beside him.
"Is your hand troubling you?"
"The lack of my hand is troubling me." The mornings were the hardest. In his dreams, Jamie was a whole man, and each dawn he would lie half awake and feel his fingers move. "It was a nightmare," some part of him would whisper, refusing to believe even now. "Only a nightmare." But then he would open his eyes.
"I understand you had a visitor last night," said Qyburn. "I trust that you, enjoyed her."
Jamie gave him a cool look. "She did not say who sent her." The maester smiled modestly.
"Your fever was largely gone, and I thought you might enjoy a bit of exercise. Pierre is quite skilled, would you not agree? And so, willing."
She had been that, certainly. She had slipped in his door and out of her clothes so quickly that Jamie had thought he was still dreaming. It hadn't been until the woman slid in under his blankets and put his good hand on her breast that he roused.
"She was a pretty little thing, too."
"I was a slip of a girl when you came for Lord Wenstorny, and the king gave you your cloak," she confessed. "You were so handsome, all in white, and everyone said what a brave knight you were. Sometimes, when I'm with some man, I close my eyes and pretend it's you on top of me, with your smooth skin and gold curls. I never truly thought I'd have you, though."
Sending her away had not been easy after that, but Jamie had done it all the same. "I have a woman," he reminded himself. "Do you send girls to everyone, you leech?" he asked Qyburn.
"More often, Lord Vargo sends them to me. He likes me to examine them before... Well, suffice it to say that once he loved unwisely, and he has no wish to do so again. But have no fear, Pierre is quite healthy, as is your maid of Tarth."
Jamie gave him a sharp look.
"Brayeen?" "Yes, a strong girl, that one, and her maidenhead is still intact, as of last night, at least."
Qyburn gave a chuckle.
"He sent you to examine her?" "To be sure, he is fastidious, shall we say."
"Does this concern the ransom?" Jamie asked. "Does her father require proof she is still a maiden?"
"You have not heard?"
Qyburn gave a shrug.
"We had a bird from Lord Selwyn in answer to mine. The Evenstar offers 300 dragons for his daughter's safe return. I told Lord Vargo there was no sapphires on Tarth, but he will not listen. He's convinced the Evenstar intends to cheat him."
300 dragons is a fair ransom for a knight. The goat should take what he can get."
"The goat is Lord of Arrenhall, and the Lord of Arrenhall does not haggle."
The news irritated him, though he supposed he should have seen it coming. "The lie spared your while, wench. Be grateful for that much.
If her maidenhead's as hard as the rest of her, the goat will break his cock off trying to get in,"
he jested. Brayeen was tough enough to survive a few rapes, Jamie judged, though if she resisted too vigorously, Vargo Hoat might start lopping off her hands and feet.
"And if he does, why should I care? I might still have a hand if she had let me have my cousin's sword without getting stupid."
He had almost taken off her leg himself with that first stroke of his, but after that she had given him more than he wanted.
"Hoat may not know how freakish strong she is. He had best be careful, or she'll snap that skinny neck of his, and wouldn't that be sweet?"
Qyburn's companionship was wearing on him. Jamie trotted toward the head of the column. Around a little tick of a Northman named Nage went before Steelshanks with a peace banner, A rainbow-striped flag with seven long tails and a staff topped by a seven-pointed star. "Shouldn't you Northmen have a different sort of peace banner?" he asked Walton. "What are the seven to you?" "Southern gods," the man said. "But it's a southern peace we need to get you safe to your father."
"My father."
Jamie wondered whether Lord Tywin had received the goat's demand for ransom, with or without his rotted hand.
"What is a swordsman worth without his sword hand? Half the gold in Castle Rock, 300 drachens, or nothing?"
His father had never been unduly swayed by sentiment. Tywin Lannister's own father, Lord Titus, had once imprisoned an unruly bannerman, Lord Tarbeck. The redoubtable Lady Tarbeck responded by capturing three Lannisters, including young Stafford, whose sister was betrothed to Cousin Tywin.
"Send back my lord and love, or these three shall answer for any harm that comes him,"
she had written to Castle Rock. Young Tywin suggested his father oblige by sending back Lord Tarbeck in three pieces. Lord Titus was a gentler sort of lion, however, so Lady Tarbeck won a few more years for her mutton-headed lord, and Stafford wed and bred and blundered on till Oxcross. But Tywin Lannister endured eternal as Castle Rock.
"And now you have a cripple for a son as well as a dwarf, my lord. How you will hate that!"
The road led them through a burned village. It must have been a year or more since the place had been put to torch. The hovel stood blackened and roofless, but weeds were growing waist-high in all the surrounding fields. Steelshanks called a halt to allow them to water the horses.
"I know this place, too,"
Jamie thought, as he waited by the well. There had been a small inn where only a few foundation stones and a chimney now stood, and he had gone in for a cup of ale. A dark-eyed serving wench brought him cheese and apples, but the innkeep had refused his coin.
"It's an honour to have a knight of the King's Guard under my roof, sir," the man had said. "It's a tale I'll tell my grandchildren."
Jamie looked at the chimney poking out of the weeds and wondered whether he had ever gotten those grandchildren.
Did he tell them the Kingslayer once drank his ale and ate his cheese and apples? Or was he ashamed to admit he fed the likes of me?
Not that he would ever know. Whoever burned the inn had likely killed the grandchildren as well. He could feel his phantom fingers clench. When Steelshank said that perhaps they should have a fire and a bit of food, Jamie shook his head.
"I mislike this place. We'll ride on."
By evenfall they had left the lake to follow a rutted track through a wood of oak and elm. Jamie's stump was throbbing dully when Steelshanks decided to make camp. Kyburn had brought a skin of dream wine, thankfully. While Walton set the watches, Jamie stretched out near the fire and propped a rolled-up bearskin against the stump as a pillow for his head. The wench would have told him he had to eat before he slept, to keep his strength up, but he was more tired than hungry. He closed his eyes and hoped he'd dreamed of Cersei. The fever dreams were all so vivid. Naked and alone he stood, surrounded by enemies, with stone walls all around him pressing close. The rock, he knew. He could feel the immense weight of it above his head. He was home. He was home and whole. He held his right hand up and flexed his fingers to feel the strength in them. It felt as good as sex, as good as swordplay.
Four fingers and a thumb.
He had dreamed that he was maimed, but it wasn't so. Relief made him dizzy.
My hand, my good hand.
Nothing could hurt him so long as he was whole. Around him stood a dozen tall, dark figures in cowled robes that hid their faces. In their hands were spears.
"Who are you?" he demanded of them. "What business do you have in Castle Rock?"
They gave no answer, only prodded him with the points of their spears. He had no choice but to descend. Down a twisting passageway he went, narrow steps carved from the living rock, down and down.
I must go up, he told himself. Up, not down. Why am I going down?
Below the earth, his doom awaited, he knew with the certainty of dream. Something dark and terrible lurked there, something that wanted him. Jamie tried to halt, but their spears prodded him on.
If only I had my sword, nothing could harm me.
The steps ended abruptly on echoing darkness. Jamie had the sense of vast space before him. He jerked to a halt, teetering on the edge of nothingness. A spear point jabbed at the small of his back, shoving him into the abyss. He shouted, but the fall was short. He landed on his hands and knees upon soft sand and shallow water. There were watery caverns deep below Castle Rock, but this one was strange to him.
What place is this?
Your place,
the voice echoed. It was 100 voices, 1,000. The voices of all the Lannisters since Lamb the Clever, who'd lived at the dawn of days. But most of all, it was his father's voice, and beside Lord Tywin stood his sister, pale and beautiful, a torch burning in her hand. Joffrey was there as well, the son they'd made together, and behind them a dozen more dark shapes with golden hair.
Sister, why has father brought us here?
Us? This is your place, brother. This is your darkness. Her torch was the only light in the cavern. Her torch was the only light in the world. She turned to go.
Stay with me, Jamie pleaded. Don't leave me here alone.
But they were leaving.
Don't leave me in the dark.
Something terrible lived down here.
Give me a sword, at least.
I gave you a sword, Lord Tywin said.
It was at his feet. Jamie groped under the water until his hand closed upon the hilt.
Nothing can hurt me so long as I have a sword.
As he raised the sword, a finger of pale flame flickered at the point and crept up along the edge, stopping a hand's breadth from the hilt. The fire took on the color of the steel itself, so it burned with a silvery blue light, and the gloom pulled back. Crouching, listening, Jamie moved in a circle, ready for anything that might come out of the darkness. The water flowed into his boots, ankle-deep and bitterly cold.
"Beware the water," he told himself. "There may be creatures living in it, hidden deeps."
From behind came a great splash. Jamie whirled toward the sound, but the faint light revealed only Brienne of Tarth, her hands bound in heavy chains.
"I swore to keep you safe," the wench said stubbornly. "I swore an oath."
Naked, she raised her hands to Jamie.
"Sir, please, if you would be so good."
The steel links parted like silk.
"A sword,"
Brienne begged. And there it was, scabbard, belt and all. She buckled it around her thick waist. The light was so dim that Jamie could scarcely see her, though they stood a scant few feet apart.
In this light, she could almost be a beauty, he thought. In this light, she could almost be a knight.
Brienne's sword took flame as well, burning silvery blue. The darkness retreated a little more. The flames will burn so long as you live, he heard Cersei call. When they die, so must you.
Sister, he shouted, stay with me, stay!
There was no reply but the soft sound of retreating footsteps. Brienne moved her longsword back and forth, watching the silvery flames shift and shimmer. Beneath her feet, a reflection of the burning blade shone on the surface of the flat black water. She was as tall and strong as he remembered, yet it seemed to Jamie that she had more of a woman shape now.
"Do they keep a bear down here?"
Brienne was moving, slow and wary, sword in hand, step, turn, and listen. Each step made a little splash.
"A cave lion? Dire wolves? Some bear? Tell me, Jamie, what lives here? What lives in the darkness?
Doom. No bear, he knew. No lion. Only doom. In the cool, silvery blue light of the swords, the big wench looked pale and fierce.
I mislike this place.
I'm not fond of it myself. Their blades made a little island of light, but all around them stretched a sea of darkness unending.
My feet are wet. We could go back the way they brought us. If you climbed on my shoulders, you'd have no trouble reaching that tunnel mouth.
Then I could follow Circe.
He could feel himself growing hard at the thought, and turned away so Brian would not see.
Listen.
She put a hand on his shoulder, and he trembled at the sudden touch.
She's warm.
Something comes.
Brian lifted her sword to point off to his left.
There.
He peered into the gloom until he saw it too.
Something was moving through the darkness, but he could not quite make it out.
A man on a horse. No, two. Two riders side by side.
Down here, beneath a rock. It made no sense.
Yet there came two riders on pale horses, men and mounts both armored. The destriers emerged from the blackness at a slow walk.
They make no sound, Jamie realized. No splashing, no clink of mail, no clop of hoof.
He remembered Eddard Stark riding the length of Aerys' throne room, wrapped in silence. Only his eyes had spoken, a lord's eyes, cold and grey and full of judgment.
"Is it you, Stark?"
Jamie called. "Come ahead. I never feared you living. I do not fear you dead."
Brian touched his arm.
"There are more."
He saw them, too. They were armoured all in snow, it seemed to him, and ribbons of mist swirled back from their shoulders. The visors of their helms were closed, but Jamie Lannister did not need to look upon their faces to know them. Five had been his brothers. Oswald Went and John Derry. Lewin Martell, a Prince of Dawn. The White Bull and Gerald Hightower. Sir Arthur Dane, Sword of the Morning. And beside them, crowned in mist and grief, with his long hair streaming behind him, rode Rhaegar Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, and rightful heir to the Iron Throne.
"You don't frighten me,"
he called, turning as they split to either side of him. He did not know which way to face.
"I will fight you one by one or all together. But who is there for the wench to duel? She gets cross when you leave her out."
"I swore an oath to keep him safe," she said to Rhaegar's shade. "I swore a holy oath."
"We all swore oaths," said Sir Arthur Dane, so sadly.
The shades dismounted from their ghostly horses. When they drew their long swords, it made not a sound.
"He was going to burn the city," Jamie said, "to leave Robert only ashes." "He was your king," said Derry.
"You swore to keep him safe," said Went.
"And the children, them as well," said Prince Lewin.
Prince Rhaegar burned with a cold light, now white, now red, now dark.
"I left my wife and children in your hands."
"I never thought it hurt them."
Jamie's sword was burning less brightly now.
"I was with the king."
"Killing the king," said Sir Arthur.
"Cutting his throat," said Prince Lewin.
"The king you had sworn to die for," said the White Bull.
The fires that ran along the blade were guttering out, and Jamie remembered what Cersei had said.
"No!"
Terror closed a hand about his throat. Then his sword went dark, and only Brienne's burned as the ghost came rushing in.
"No," he said, "no, no, no!"
Heart pounding, he jerked awake, and found himself in starry darkness amidst a grove of trees. He could taste bile in his mouth, and he was shivering with sweat, hot and cold at once. When he looked down for his sword hand, his wrist ended in leather and linen, wrapped snug around an ugly stump. He felt sudden tears well up in his eyes.
I felt it. I felt the strength in my fingers and the rough leather of my sword's grip, my hand.
My lord!
Kyburn knelt beside him, his fatherly face all crinkly with concern.
What is it? I heard you cry out.
Still Shanks Walton stood above them, tall and dour.
What is it? Why did you scream?
A dream. Only a dream. Jamie stared at the camp around him, lost for a moment.
I was in the dark, but I had my hand back.
He looked at the stump and felt sick all over again.
There's no place like that beneath a rock, he thought.
His stomach was sour and empty, and his head was pounding where he'd pillowed it against the stump. Kyburn felt his brow.
You still have a touch of fever.
A fever dream. Jamie reached up.
Help me.
Steel Shanks took him by his good hand and pulled him to his feet.
Another cup of dream wine?
Asked Kyburn.
No, I've dreamt enough this night.
He wondered how long it was till dawn. Somehow he knew that if he closed his eyes, he would be back in that dark, wet place again.
Milk of the poppy, then, and something for your fever. You're still weak, my lord. You need to sleep, to rest.
That is the last thing I mean to do.
The moonlight glimmered pale upon the stump where Jamie had rested his head. The moss covered it so thickly he had not noticed before, but now he saw that the wood was white. It made him think of Winterfell and Ned Stark's heart tree.
It was not him, he thought. It was never him.
But the stump was dead, and so was Stark, and so were all the others, Prince Rhaegar and Sir Arthur and the children.
And Aerys. Aerys is most dead of all.
Do you believe in ghosts, maester?
He asked Kyburn. The old man's face grew strange.
Once, at the citadel, I came into an empty room and saw an empty chair, yet I knew a woman had been there only a moment before. The cushion was dented where she'd sat. The cloth was still warm, and her scent lingered in the air. If we leave our smells behind us when we leave a room, surely something of our souls must remain when we leave this life.
Kyburn spread his hands.
The archmaesters did not like my thinking, though. Well, Marwyn did, but he was the only one.
Jamie ran his fingers through his hair.
Walton, he said, suddenly orders. I want to go back.
Back?
Steel Shanks regarded him dubiously.
He thinks I've gone mad, and perhaps I have.
I left something at Arranal.
Lord Vargo owes it now, him and his bloody mummers.
You have twice the men he does. If I don't serve you up to your father, as commanded, Lord Bolton will have my hide. We press on to King's Landing.
Once Jamie might have countered with a smile and a threat, but one-handed cripples do not inspire much fear. He wondered what his brother would do.
Tyrion would find a way.
Lannister's lie, Steelshanks. Didn't Lord Bolton tell you that?
The man frowned suspiciously.
What if he did?
Unless you take me back to Arranhal, the song I sing my father may not be the one the Lord of the Dreadfort would wish to hear. I might even say it was Bolton ordered my hand cut off, and Steelshanks Walton who swung the blade.
Walton gaped at him.
That isn't so.
No, but who will my father believe?
Jamie made himself smile, the way he used to smile when nothing in the world could frighten him.
It will be so much easier if we just go back. We'd be on our way again soon enough, and I'd sing such a sweet song in King's Landing, you'll never believe your ears. You'd get the girl and a nice fat purse of gold as thanks.
Gold?
Walton liked that well enough.
How much gold?
I have him. Why, how much would you want?